91-133-5832.
Estás escuchando.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio. You're listening.
Vaughan Radio.
Welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams. You are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on this program, I'm going to talk about a moment in the history of the United States which is very special, the first part of the 19th century, the United States itself, recently formed, trying to consolidate all these different kinds of people, all of these new things, and of course, expansion, the tension between the slave states and the free states, which will inevitably lead to a conflict, a civil war, people very, very interested in trying to postpone this as long as possible. One of them, President Martin Van Buren. Now, one of the things that you should remember about Martin Van Buren is that his nickname was Old Kinderhook, and Kinderhook, a place that he was associated with. Old Kinderhook, when he ran for office, evidently, Old Kinderhook was reduced to its initials, O.K. And evidently, this is the origin of our OK. It was a political slogan in its beginning. And yes, people have traced it. Nobody prior to the 1830s had ever heard of it. However, after the 1830s, it became common usage and continues that way today. And so, OK. Spelled, by the way, O-K-A-Y, right? Because I've seen people try to, I've seen non-natives try to spell it differently. It can be used as initials, the letter O followed by the letter K, or as O-K-A-Y. And this from Old Kinderhooks from Martin Van Buren. Now, the very fact that Martin Van Buren was elected president is somewhat surprising because he did have a lot of opposition, being, as he was, of Dutch ancestry. And remember that New York was originally New Amsterdam. And that the entire Hudson River Valley was populated by people of Dutch extraction. And these people were, in many ways, considered second-class citizens. at thought of themselves as discriminated against unfairly, thought of themselves as victims. That began to change in the 19th century, and one of the people most responsible for that was the author Washington Irving. Washington Irving began to write about these people, and many of his short stories, some of his novels, are ambientados, are set in the Dutch area of the Hudson River Valley. One of them really, really famous, one of them which had a great impact in the 19th century. It was a bestseller, and everybody talks about it. Well, one of them is a horror story about the Headless Horseman, who has a jack-o'-lantern, right? One of those calabazas, the big ones, the kind, the Halloween style. As a head, and he rides with it next to him. And this, of course, a kind of a 19th century horror story, which has been reproduced extensively in cartoons and movies. But the one that had the greatest impact at the time was Rip Van Winkle. The protagonist, the main character, Rip Van Winkle, is out in the countryside, and he discovers sort of a little people from Dutch mythology, from legend. A little like the Irish leprechauns, but in this case from Dutch ancestry. And once these supernatural creatures have been discovered, naturally they cannot let Rip Van Winkle tell anyone about what he has seen. So what they do is put him to sleep. And because they are using their supernatural powers, he sleeps for 25 years. And when he has woken up, the world has changed completely. When he has woken up, the English are in charge, the revolution, all of these things, technological progress, all of these things that he never expected. The world has been transformed. And because at that time, things were moving so fast, you know, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, this idea of Rip Van Winkle really hit home. That there was a deep echo in American society. And even today, you can say, when you're confronted with disruptive technology, oh, you say, wow, I feel like Rip Van Winkle, like I have just woken up from 25 years of sleep. In any case, the cumulative effect of these novels and short stories by Washington Irving was to create a kind of nostalgia, an appreciation of this subculture that previously had been sort of ignored and maybe discriminated against. And the beginnings of American romanticism, because these people were romanticized. And of course, simultaneously you have a whole style of painting based on the Hudson River Valley, a very, very sort of romantic landscape paintings that did quite a lot to put this area on people's mental maps. And just like one of the things that you use every day, or you hear every day, that you come into contact with, okay. This comes from the time of Martin Van Buren, the Dutch president. And there wasn't going to be another Dutch president until the Roosevelts. Another creation from this time was the Dutch figure of Father Christmas, Saint Nicholas, the one they call Santa Claus. Santa Claus from Saint Nicholas, Santa Claus. And the creation of Santa Claus, the celebration of Santa Claus as a figure, is from this time. And it is 100% Dutch. Which is why, of course, it was late getting to England, and why they still refer to him more as Father Christmas than as Santa Claus. It is very, very foreign to the British way of thinking. But it came out of the United States and out of this sort of romantic celebration of the Dutch heritage. And one of the beneficiaries, Martin Van Buren. Now, Martin Van Buren, as president, kept America out of war. He prevented war. He didn't like war. He wanted to stop war. And of course, as such, he is not remembered as a hero. But what he did was very, very heroic. He had been Secretary of State, in other words, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and he had also been Vice President. He was a very, very good politician. He knew how to talk to anyone about anything. He could convince anyone, and in reasonable tones. Not the stentorian, you know, not the oratory that was so common in the 19th century. People like Daniel Webster, he avoided that. And, or at least had the reputation of speaking simply, plainly. So yes, he was president in 1836 when the Mexican province of Texas declared its independence and requested annexation by the United States. Now, naturally, this followed a fiasco of a battle, San Jacinto, in modern-day Houston, Texas. The Battle of San Jacinto, in which Santana, the Mexican president, was captured, and went home. One man responsible for the loss of Texas, a disaster as a general at this point. In any case, Santa Anna lost Texas, and when he returned to Mexico City, the collective response was, "You did what? We're not going to recognize that." And so, yes, it took Mexico a very, very long time to reconcile itself to the independence of Texas. Texas applied for statehood. And Van Buren, said no. Van Buren, who had worked under Andrew Jackson, the expansionist president, right? The Western president, the one who really didn't care about going to war and didn't care about diplomacy. But Van Buren was made of other stuff. He rejected the Texans, and after a 2-year period of sort of a diplomacy and patience, working with the Mexicans, he convinced them to agree to a certain arbitration. Now, under the terms of that arbitration, Texas was going to be semi-autonomous. There would be no American annexation. It would be autonomous. And the Mexicans thought they could live with that, with the idea that, in the best cases, that they could win back the hearts and minds of the rebels in Texas. And Van Buren explained that the United States could not do anything as cheap and low as simply grabbing Texas, swallowing Texas, because, I quote, "We have a character among the nation of the earth to maintain." In other words, it was a question of character. It was a question of ethics, morality. Among the nations of the earth, they can be our judges. We give them the right to judge us. So yes, he said, and I quote, "The lust," this is kind of lujuria, but desire, uncontrolled desire, "that the lust for power with fraud and violence has led to other and different constituted governments to aggression and conquest. Our movements in these respects have always been regulated by reason and justice." And he was writing at a time when you could still say that, because very shortly afterwards, things were going to change, and they were going to change radically. In any case, coming from that success, although it cost him a great deal of popularity to be so reasonable, Van Buren had an entirely different problem on the northern border. On an earlier program, I believe it was the program before last, I was speaking about what happened with Canada, this difficult relationship between Canada and the United States, and how, during the War of 1812, as part of the Napoleonic Wars, the British intruded on American independence. They decided there was too much at stake, right? Demasiado en juego. Too much at stake. And Britain was fighting for its life, and embargo American ships or freight, and they could use or kidnap, sequestrar, American sailors or citizens to help with that war effort. and that if the United States did anything to help Napoleon, who had been a great benefactor to the United States, if the United States reciprocated and tried to benefit Napoleon, that it would be severely punished. And of course, the closest British stronghold was Canada. Canada was filled with people who had been living in the 13 colonies before independence, who were loyal to the British crown, but whose lives had been made impossible, who were forced into exile in the course of American independence. So this was a fifth column living in Canada. Okay, that was 1812, the War of 1812. Then down in New Orleans, the British pretty much lost that war, and a peace was signed, and as quickly as possible, the United States and Britain tried to forget that they had ever been at war or hostilities of any kind, tried to forget that the British had attacked Washington, D.C. and burned down every public building they came into contact with, scrupulously respecting private buildings, but burning the public buildings, including the White House, the Capitol, and, well, anything they could find. Now, all of that made better with this new peace between Britain and the United States. As learners of English, you will, of course, have discovered the many differences between American English and British English in terms of spelling. Now, all of those, spelling, punctuation, things like that, all of those have their reason for being. Many of the things that are considered Americanisms by the British are, in fact, from Britain. For example, saying aluminum instead of aluminium. Little things like this. Common in Britain, then common in the United States, and then Britain changed. There are many things like this. But the spelling conventions, all of that was the work of a man named Noah Webster, who was trying to make an American dictionary and looking for some way to demonstrate American independence, that now that they were a free country, they had their own language and their own possibility to express themselves. And so he is the one who recommended, for example, color be spelled C-O-L-O-R, not C-O-L-O-U-R, color, flavor. Meter, M-E-T-E-R, instead of meter, instead of metre, as the British do. Or theater, as theater, instead of theatre, the way the British do. I've had many, many spelling reforms that were happening at this time. But of course, after the War of 1812, there was no real reason to proceed with any of this. And with diplomatic relations reestablished, why manifest this kind of difference? And so the entire project started and then stopped with just enough of a difference to drive the rest of us crazy. Because when you have to teach it, when you have to learn it, American English or British English? American English. Traveler with two L's, jewelry with two L's. All of these things are extraordinarily frustrating. And they come out of this time. Now, there could have been another war. It could have been so much worse. In New England, there, in constant contact with Canada, the War of 1812 had never ended. On the Canadian border, patriots and anti-British sentiment was ready for anything. There were all sorts of skirmishes with the British forces in Canada. Okay, I have to take a break now. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
Estás escuchando
Bon Radio.
Bon Radio.
Mira, los de Vaughan.
Claro, están aquí en la calle Orense 69.
No, ahí en la esquina.
Anda, es verdad, han abierto una tienda.
Abierta de lunes a jueves de 10 a 2 y de 3 a 7 de la tarde y los viernes a las 11 de la mañana.
¿Tus hijos tienen entre 10 y 18 años? ¿Quieres mandarlos al extranjero a aprender inglés este verano? Sin riesgos y con total confianza, mándalos a un campamento en Canadá con Vaughan. Pasarán 4 semanas de acampada en un paraje de ensueño junto a chicos y chicas canadienses, con muy pocos alumnos hispanohablantes para que tengan que comunicarse en inglés sí o sí. Nosotros nos encargamos de todo para que no tengas que preocuparte de nada. Vuelo de ida y vuelta, alojamiento, pensión completa, actividades con monitores, todo incluido en el precio. Llámanos ya al 91-133-5832 e infórmate sin compromiso. Campamentos de Inglés en Canadá, 91-133-5832.
I started to learn English when I was very, very young. My tip for somebody who is learning English is be brave and don't be afraid of exaggerating an accent. You're free to go anywhere you want.
Be like Marta. Be like them.
Descubre más en grupovaughan.com.
Vaughan y Víctor Ullate sumaron sus décadas de experiencia en la enseñanza del inglés y en la formación de danza y artes escénicas para crear un campamento único que ayudará a los participantes a desarrollar todo su talento artístico.
La Escuela de Danza y Artes Escénicas Víctor Ullate cuenta con más de 30 años de experiencia en la formación de danza clásica, danza moderna y artes escénicas. Junto con Vaughan hemos creado una inmersión lingüística a través de múltiples actividades, juegos, talleres, de manera que los niños en el campamento no solo se formen y demuestren su talento, sino que se sientan también seguros y muy cómodos con el idioma.
Buscamos fomentar la faceta artística y creativa de los niños a través de una formación especializada en el mundo de las artes escénicas en un entorno angloparlante, donde pierdan el miedo a hablar en inglés y utilicen el idioma en su vida cotidiana mientras se divierten y desarrollan su potencial. Son las últimas plazas. No dejes pasar esta convocatoria. Campamento Vaughan con la Escuela de Danza y Artes Escénicas Víctor Ullate. Infórmate en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Yeah.
Canarias Radio.
Escuchando Baugan Radio.
Welcome back. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. Now, on the first part of the program, I was talking about President Martin Van Buren and the cultural background that he had as being of Dutch ancestry and Dutch New York, and some of the common things to come out of that. One of them is okay. Another is Santa Claus. All of this rich source that had been romanticized by the author Washington Irving. Remember that Washington Irving joined the diplomatic corps and was stationed in Spain. He spent years in Spain, and it was in Spain that, as a member of the diplomatic corps, he simply assigned himself to Granada and absorbed all of the stories surrounding the Alhambra and wrote them down in a book called Tales of the Alhambra, so that he began to do for Spain what he had done already for the Hudson Valley in New York. And yes, once a romantic, always a romantic. Andalusia is going to be one of the cradles. Let's put it that way: a cradle, cuna, one of the cradles of romanticism in Europe. And Irving, largely responsible for this. Irving will create an enormous fund of goodwill, predisposition, Robert Nye? Soft power. Today you talk a lot about soft power, how a country's reputation can predispose people toward it or against it. And this kind of soft power helped. Spanish soft power helped in the United States with the publication of Tales of the Alhambra by Washington Irving. Remember that later on, America is going to go crazy for everything Spanish, and that an author like Blasco Ibáñez will be the number one bestseller in the United States, in translation, naturally. But yes, Sorolla and Zuloaga doing their best work in the United States. They were adored. And the creation of the Hispanic Society of America with an enormous budget. Still today, you can go visit it. It is an astonishing place. In any case, all of that brought about, at least initially, by Washington Irving. Now, I spoke about how Martin Van Buren was successfully able to avoid a war with Mexico through negotiation and arbitration. Postpone a war with Mexico. Yes, because you're going to have another president in office who wants to provoke that war and who will do anything to provoke that war. And it happens. But this is a decade later. But at least Martin Van Buren kept America out of that war. And kept America out of a war with England as well. It had been two decades since the War of 1812. But up by the Canadian border, places like Maine, Vermont, it's as if the war had never ended. There were constant skirmishes and constant calls for an invasion. And the consensus among journalists at that time was that war is unavoidable. It will happen. Van Buren chose as his point man, as his representative, the great, the undisputed hero of the War of 1812. The victor, let's put it that way, over England, Winfield Scott. General Winfield Scott was sent on a peace mission to the Canadian border to calm things down. However, while he was organizing things, in the state of Maine, where Canadians had taken over a disputed area and refused to leave, the governor of Maine called the state militia in order to expel them. The governor of the state sent a letter to the president, a letter filled with disdain and vitriol, a letter that is absolutely insolent and indicates that, of course, at this time, the balance between states' rights and a federal government was still to be decided, still in the future. Remember that just a generation later, when states begin to leave the United States and declare themselves independent, part of a confederacy, to say that they no longer wished to form part of the Union, they believed themselves to have this constitutional right to leave. They believed that what Lincoln was trying to do, maintain the Union by force, that this was completely untenable. There was no way you could argue that. That was certainly not in the Constitution. That was tyranny. It was an abrogation of his duty to respect the Constitution. In any case, the governor of Maine now says to the president of the United States, if you go against us upon this occasion, or if you do not espouse, meaning advocate, our cause with warmth and with true American feeling, God only knows what the results will be politically. A kind of an ultimatum to the President of the United States. Now, because this war was becoming more and more popular, evidently the press was talking about it all the time, and so public opinion was going in favor, and Congress authorized $10 million and 50,000 volunteers for this endeavor, for this this project, this mission. People began to burn the president in effigy. And this is how the Aroostook War began. Now, if the term Aroostook War does not ring a bell, there's a reason for that, and the reason is Martin Van Buren. And if President Martin Van Buren doesn't ring a bell, sino o suena, if it doesn't ring a bell, it's because he was a peace president. Van Buren sent his man, General Winfield Scott, on another mission looking for peace with honor. He made it very clear to the governor of Maine and the people of Maine that the federal government was not interested in helping them, and they could expect no aid, no militia. If their militia provoked an incident, they were on their own. The idea was, if there's going to be a war, then it should be a national war. You do not allow one state to get the entire country involved in a war. Martin Van Buren asked his son to deliver a message personally to the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Palmerston, saying that war was the last thing on his mind, that he is not going to let his country fall into a war because of the fault of a single state, and that he would not, peace would be easy if the wishes of the men in power of both countries were alone to be consulted. In other words, there have to be adults in the room. Palmerston understood what was at stake, right, en juego. And he referred to Mr. Van Buren, President Van Buren, as enlightened, ilustrado. Enlightened. Several years later, they signed a treaty with Britain, bringing all the questions, all the disputes to an easy solution. Now,
If the people want war, it's very, very difficult to bring them back and then not get punished, right? Get reelected. I mean, Van Buren lost his reelection campaign in 1840. And that there were people telling him that the only way he could win that campaign was to do something bellicose, right? To show that he was a war president and win back public attention and goodwill because of his warrior stance. Well, Van Buren said no. He said he was willing to resist any invasion, any incursion on America's rights, but he was equally prepared to leave other people to do their thing, right? To stay out of the affairs of other countries. A strict neutrality is the way he referred to it. And that cost him the election. Now, this pro-war sentiment, it was still cooking. And it was going to find an outlet in Mexico by the year 1846. Now, the fact is that the Mexican-American War, which many people know very little about and which many people, at least in the United States, would like to forget entirely, they can't really give you a coherent explanation of what happened. Although, of course, the people in Mexico know exactly what happened and can give you a full explanation of the... Well, I mean, they've never forgotten. They commemorate this. Memorialize the loss, which in many ways is very painful for them to speak about. In any case, serving in that war, well, the average length of service was 13 months. And for many people, it was a very sort of short thing, but at the same time, very deadly. Being exposed to fighting during that time, the fatality ratio per year of service for the Mexican War was about 15%. In other words, of the 51,750 people who volunteered, who enrolled, almost 8,000 of them died. So the probability of getting killed in the Mexican-American War, was one out of six or seven. Now, this was ultimately as successful for the United States. It was Mexico City was taken. And the people there were forced to sign the treaty. The American representative there didn't like the situation, didn't like what he was doing. The Mexican representative said something like, "This is the moment of your triumph and our humiliation." And the American representative said, "No, the situation is much more humiliating for my country, or at least this is what his wife says that he said at that time. Now, future president Ulysses Grant, right, the great Civil War hero, said that the Mexican-American War was one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger nation against a weaker nation. And he said, an instance of a republic following the bad examples of European monarchies in not considering justice in their desire to acquire additional territory. And this was the consensus of many people at the time. Although, of course, the prize was too great to pass up, the annexation of Texas, and then, of course, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and California, Alta California. Grant said, the Southern Rebellion, meaning the Civil War, the Southern Rebellion was largely the outgrowth of the Mexican War. In other words, the Mexican War precipitated a civil war in the United States. It triggered the war. Nations, like individuals, are punished for their transgressions. We got our punishment in the most sanguinary and expensive war of modern times. In other words, Grant was convinced that this Civil War was God's way of punishing America for what it had done to Mexico. Now, within this, there were advantages and disadvantages. The advantage of the North, most of the industrial capacity was there. The South had very few factories. The North could easily blockade the Southern ports. The South had potential allies in the form of the ones that the countries that they supplied cotton to. This is England and France. Any day that England and France decided to join the war and to help the South with its independence, that would have been the end of the North. That would have been the end of the conflict. The United States would have been permanently divided into Confederate states and the Federation, or the Union states. Now, the South was dependent on river transportation, and all of the rivers flowed from the North to the South. However, in spite of these disadvantages, they had many, many things going for them, and they could easily have won. Okay, this is a subject for another program. I'll be talking about this on my next program. Please listen.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio.
Vaughn Radio.
Estás escuchando Vaughn Radio.
You're listening.
Lo que escuchas,
Vaughn Radio.
Buscamos fomentar la faceta artística y creativa de los niños a través de una formación especializada en el mundo de las artes escénicas en un entorno angloparlante, donde pierdan el miedo a hablar en inglés y utilicen el idioma en su vida cotidiana mientras se divierten y desarrollan su potencial. Son las últimas plazas. No dejes pasar esta convocatoria. Campamento Vaughan con la Escuela de Danza y Artes Escénicas Víctor Ullate. Infórmate en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
I learned English at a very young age, and that's why I studied translation. Every mistake you make is actually an opportunity to learn.